olfactory system.
Thank you. So I'm a pattern formation person and have worked for many years, as many of my close friends in the audience know, on the patterns in convection and trying to understand those. But I had a sabbatical coming up a year ago, and I decided to take a break from convection and explore a system which is notoriously difficult and has a lot of complex patterns in time and somewhat in space. And so today's talk is somewhat a summary of what I did during my sabbatical rather than a summary of the theory of the nose, of which I'll tell you up front does not exist at the moment. And it's more a sense of what I, as a theoretical physicist, tried to digest during that year, and some of the things that I learned and some of the things that I wish I'd learned, in the sense that the data that I was looking for doesn't exist yet. And I think there's a need for the community, the neurobiology community, to do some different kinds of experiments. So let me begin by giving you an outline of what I'll talk about. First, I'd like to explain why I'm talking about olfaction as opposed to some other part of the brain. Then I'd like to give you about five or six slides, a crash course on neurobiology. I crystallize what I think are the most important five or six ideas that people outside of neurobiology should know. Then I'd like to show you some experiments about olfaction to give you a sense of what the state of the art is in terms of obtaining data about the nose. And then, depending on how much time's left, I'll give you a summary of what some of the progress has been in theory. And if I have enough time, I'll show you a quick glimpse of one of the leading theories of how the nose accomplishes what it does. And then I'll give you my conclusions. So first, this question, why think about olfaction? From my ignorant point of view as a theorist, as a physicist who doesn't know that much about biology, the whole field of the brain seems spherically difficult, to steal a phrase from Freeman Dyson. If you go to talks on the brain and talk to people who work on the brain, it seems that everybody runs into the same kind of trouble no matter what part of the brain they're thinking about. So if you're looking at vision, olfaction, motor control, memory, and so on, people can go about two layers of neurons in from the outside of their body, and then all hell breaks loose and no one knows what the hell's going on. So the brain does seem like a spherically difficult problem, and I got interested in olfaction mainly because my symmetry was broken by a rather charismatic neurobiologist by the name of Larry Katz, whom I met in Colorado a couple of years back at a research, at a workshop designed to try to bring theorists and biologists together. So other than random breaking of my symmetry, there are some arguments for choosing olfaction. It's the widest and oldest of the senses that among in the animal kingdom. Humans are particularly bad at smelling. That's probably one of the sacrifices we made to become upright, which put our nose far above the ground. We're so far away from the smells that count or dominate in an animal's life. But for nearly all species except humans, odor is extremely important. How important, I'll show you in a few minutes when I show you some of the data on mice. Another one is that olfaction, how the nose works, seems to be as interesting as any of the other senses in terms of involving all the key mysteries of what makes neurobiology worth thinking about as a branch of science. So when you smell something, there's some kind of electrical activation of spikes or signals going through the fibers into your brain. How those signals are transformed into certain representations, how those representations are identified or recognized as a particular pattern, let's say the smell of a fox as a predator if you're a rabbit, how that pattern is not only recognized but matched to something in memory, how that memory is generated and stored, all these issues come up with every different part of the brain, and olfaction seems to be as interesting and as rich as the others. And then perhaps one of the strongest motivations for going olfaction is an experimental advantage of olfaction over other parts of the brain. So this is a highly magnified piece of mouse brain. And these two large segments right here, which is about, I don't know, maybe about a sixth of the mass of the mouse brain by weight, is the olfactory bulb that the mouse uses for processing the smell from its nose. And these things stick way out. This is where the snout of the mouse would be. And so this part of the brain is actually highly accessible. For example, Larry Katz in his lab can thin the skull right over the olfactory bulb to the point where he can actually image in real time what a behaving, the changes in the dynamics of the tissue. And that's quite difficult to do. So here's a human brain, and the equivalent of these two olfactory bulbs are these tiny little things, at least tiny compared to the human brain, and they're buried far under the cortex, and it's really hard to get at these things experimentally. So for humans, olfactory experiments are quite difficult. But because animals have snouts, it's quite easy to get access to these, and you can visualize them and do many kinds of experiments that are quite difficult to do. Yes?
Size-wise, they're roughly the same?
This entire mouse brain is just a little bit bigger than the olfactory bulb of a human. And for reasons that I don't understand, the mouse has far more exquisite sensing smell capabilities than a human. Sorry? Yeah, we actually have, in terms of raw mass, we actually have pretty sizable bulbs, but for reasons that I don't think anyone knows, the mouse, it's the ratio of the mass that seems to count. The mouse has far superior ability to smell and discriminate objects than humans do, even though technically we have the same amount of hardware to, or at least by mass, the same amount of hardware. So let me give you, to help you appreciate what I'm leading up to, let me give you a crash course in neurobiology. From a scientific point of view, especially from a theoretical physics point of view, I think the crucial question to aim for, or that I was struggling for the entire year of my sabbatical, is what is the state of this neurological tissue, or the olfactory tissue, that I could try to develop some quantitative equations for. So the question of state is a complex one. Let me just remind you that for a glass of water, there are many levels you can think of it. You can go down to the quantum level of the actual molecules. You can pretend the molecules are classical and just look at the collisions, or you can go to the hydrodynamic level. And there's these three different descriptions depending on what kinds of questions, what kinds of timescales you're interested in. And people are still trying to sort out what are the right timescales and hierarchy of description to work with in the nose. So the first thing you should know about the brain is something that you perhaps already know, which is that it's made of some of the most complex cells in the body, which are these neurons. Neurons you can think of as an input region that's connected to a cell body, and then an output region called the axon, so the dendrites. They come in different shapes. This is the simple bipolar form that occurs in your eye and in the first layer of your nose. These are the pyramidal cells that occur in the cortex and are the origin of the EEG waves that medical doctors would measure. And this is the extraordinary input tree, a dendritic tree of the Purkinje cells that are at the cerebellum of the back of your head, and still not fully understood what the cerebellum does, what these cells do. But one thing you should appreciate is this dendritic tree talks to 100,000 of the neurons at once. So try to decipher what this cell is doing, somehow you have to determine what those 100,000 pieces of data are flowing into. That's a completely unsolved problem. No one has the faintest idea technologically at this point how to measure what the input is into this one Purkinje cell. And there are 50 to 100 million of these things in your brain. So that's pretty complex. The next step of your quick course in neurobiology is to appreciate that each of these cells acts like a bag with a different concentrations of ions inside and out of the bag. So for mammalian neurons, potassium and sodium are particularly important for transmitting signals. The concentration of potassium inside the cell is about 140 millimolar, which is substantially greater than the amount of potassium outside the cell. There's a reverse gradient of sodium. There's relatively little sodium inside these neurons and a large gradient outside. Chlorine has a similar gradient to sodium with a lot being outside. And then calcium has an extremely tiny amount inside the cell and a moderate amount outside. Calcium is somewhat of in a category of its own, since calcium triggers all kinds of chemical reactions inside the cell. And unlike these other three, doesn't exist solely to activate electrical signals. So what are these ions good for? So this is a crude picture, but a key one of what neurons are. The axons that I showed you, these output things, are an excitable medium that are designed to send electrical signals long distances from one part of the body to another. So the cell membrane, which is these blue lipid layers, about 2 to 4 nanometers in size, they're studded with these extremely complex molecules called channels that can change their shape. They're electrically charged proteins that can change their shape. And depending on the electrical voltage across the cell, these guys can open up and let ions of one particular kind through. One of the magical properties of these channels is they're exquisitely selective, and only sodium ions will go through one of these, and these potassium channels, only potassium ones will go through, and so on. So what happens is the following. There's these sodium channels, which are basically open all the time, and a little bit of the high gradient of potassium ions leaks out, giving you a little bit of a positive charge here and a little bit of a negative charge here. You should think of this membrane as a capacitor. If you, with an electrode or by some other means, increase the voltage, making the outside more positive compared to the negative, eventually these channels change, the sodium channels change their shape and suddenly go from closed to open, and you get a flood of sodium current coming in. And so what happens here is the voltage, which is negative at the equilibrium position for potassium, starts to go quickly towards the value that would balance the sodium currents. As the voltage changes, it causes the proteins nearby in the membrane to change their shape, and these start to open, and then you get this excitable reaction where the flow of sodium at one point triggers the change in shape of the sodium gates further on, and then there's a complex opening and closing of the sodium and potassium channels. I'm not going to go into the full details, but then the result is you get what the neurobiologists call a spike, where the unactivated neuron is just resting with a negative potential of about minus 65 millivolts, and then when it's activated, you get this big sharp spike that lasts about a millisecond, and then the system recovers until the next activation occurs. These are the fundamental units of communication in the nervous system, these 1 millisecond long spikes that are sent down. So here's an extremely important point that I learned during my sabbatical, which I hadn't appreciated. These channels are crucial signatures or crucial degrees of freedom that you need to understand in thinking about a neuron. So when I show you this anatomical picture, what I've now learned to appreciate is you've got to look beyond the physical structure. You need to think of each one of these little pieces as coated with these, or having these little channels embedded with them. And each neuron is believed to have a unique signature of its own particular choice of channels. So the channels are distributed spatially in a non-uniform way. Some of the potassium or sodium channels, there might be larger amounts here, and smaller amounts here, and larger amounts here, and so on. And each one of these cells, even though they're already geometrically complicated, are even more complicated because there's a largely invisible distribution of channels across each cell. And these channels are basically what help tune or design the functionality. So for example, when some kind of signal comes in way out here, the fact that that signal can actually survive through this long network of wire-like objects to get to here is a function of all the channels that are going on and off and that can multiply or amplify that signal. So it's not sufficient just to draw a picture of a neuron and say this is an input and this is output. At some point along the line, if you really want to understand the dynamics of what these things are capable of, someone has to map out the spatial distribution of the channels and their properties. This is something I found really annoying when I was taking this introductory graduate neurobiology course. They said, well, we have 40 potassium channels and we have 30 sodium channels, and I was saying, no, I don't want to hear this stuff. This is way too much information for me to say, and I kept saying, can I ignore this and just say there's one potassium channel, and they look at me like I'm a total idiot and say, no, this is what neurobiology is really about. These cells really do have these complex, rich distributions of channels, and they were very skeptical that myself or any other theorist was going to make any progress in understanding the dynamics of these things unless you really do pay attention to the channels. So it's not clear, when you talk to biologists, it's not clear when they say you need to know something, you really need to know it. But the details there, that at some point will have to be taken into account. The spatial distributions of many different kinds of channels is an important feature of neurobiological cells. So this is an example of the spike trains that you see. This is data from Gilles Laurent's lab at Caltech, and what you're looking at, what he did was put electrodes into the second level of the smelling apparatus of a locus. They're these sensors that actually react to the chemicals. They send signals to the next neurons, which are these projection neurons, as they're called. So these are three simultaneous electrodes, or three simultaneous recordings, three electrodes simultaneously implanted into this part of the, what I call a non-behaving locus. Non-behaving means someone tore its head open and anesthetized it so the thing wouldn't move around. And so they're measuring data from an animal that's not doing its normal, following its normal behavioral patterns. And what you see here are the spikes. So here, these are these one millisecond long spikes. And what you're seeing is what happens when the nose of, or the antennae of the locus was exposed to a 1 second exposure of cherry smell. And so you see there's some spikes firing before, the odor even appears. And then when the odors appear, these three samples, there are about 800 projection neurons. The world's technology allows us to measure at most about 20 projection neurons out of these 100 in the locus at a time. But what you see is a sampling of the response of these three kinds of neurons. So this one, for example, becomes deactivated or inhibited. No spikes occur during the cherry smell. This one fires a small burst and then goes quiescent. This guy waits a little bit. There's a little bit of a delay and then suddenly starts firing. And if you take these three same projection neurons and expose the antennae to spearmint smell, then what you see is a different pattern of activation. This one now goes quiescent. This guy is evidently very excited about spearmint smell and fires a long burst. Notice how the burst persists after the smell disappears. And this one has another one of these complex little bursts and then goes to sleep and so on. Just from this picture alone, it'd be quite easy for you to detect the difference between spearmint and cherry just by looking at the pattern of bursts. And there are 800 of these guys presumably reacting in each of the symmetric halves of the olfactory structure of a locus. Each one of these is itself firing. So you can think of this as an 800-dimensional vector where each one of these is sporadically sending spikes of this kind. Question? It is I'll show you in a minute, or in a few minutes, examples of the reproducibility. These details are not reproducible. Certain statistical features are.
Question. These are individual neurons?
These are individual neurons.
Could you go back to the previous picture and
sure.
tell us what? No, well, or the that one.
Right.
Well, what is being measured? You know?
Yes. None of these cells correspond to the projection neurons, but the closest one would be something like this. What's been done is an electrode's been inserted into the body, an extremely fine electrode's been inserted into the body of one of these projection neurons. There's an input array receiving data, I'll explain this in a minute, from the many sensors that convert the chemical odors into electrical spikes. And then this thing is basically, what's being recorded is the activation state of the cell body as it as the input comes in, depending on the smell, this thing starts triggering spikes.
So it's a voltage difference.
It's the voltage difference.
The membrane at that point.
It's the voltage. Yeah, that's exactly right. And that raises questions about what the rest of this stuff is doing. The voltage is not constant along this apparatus. And
would it pick them up by coincidence?
It's actually exactly right. They put it. No, so the, so they take a needle and they start sliding it in. They do this in a very 1920-ish way. They take a needle and they slide it into the brain of the locus and they listen with earphones. I'm going to show you an example of what they hear. And they hear some clicking, and when the clicking sounds from their experience to be the right part of the brain, then they start recording data. And then they have methods to record where the end of the electrode is. They give a big pulse of electricity which causes a little burn in the brain, and then they sacrifice the locus and section it and find out exactly where the electrode was. It's laborious. It's good reasons why people go into theoretical physics rather than biology. So let me show an example of...
When you say cherry or spearmint, is that a single molecule or is it a combination of...
No, the cherry they used was, I think, Orthodox cough syrup certified. It's a mixture. It's a mixture.
You look at the response to a large number of different kinds of molecules.
It's a supermolecule, and as I'll explain in a minute, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It turns out that the way the olfactory sensors work, you cannot tell the difference between a mixture and a pure molecule, as I'll explain in a minute. So let me show you an example of an outstanding neurobiological experiment to give you a flavor for how what kind of experiments are being done. This was done in Larry Katz's lab by one of his postdocs, Min-Min Liu, also in collaboration with Michael Fee, who was at Bell Labs but is now at MIT. So here's the experiment they're doing. This is a male mouse. It's of a certain genetic type called a BALB-C, and you can't see it. It'll be clear in the movie. This mouse has a rather intricate device attached to its head, glued to its head. These are three little motors that can slide wires independently in and out of different parts of the brain separately. So this is an example of nanotechnology or microtechnology in action. It's quite a feat to design three little tiny motors that can independently slide wires. And so while the mouse is alive and active, and for all practical purpose seems to be perfectly happy with this complicated apparatus glued to its head, the experimentalists can slide these wires in and out of the different parts of the olfactory bulb and study what the electrical response is. So what they've done, this experiment is actually probing a different, as you might know or perhaps don't know, all mammals except humans have two inputs of odor. We have our nose, which is the main generalist smelling system, and there's something called the vomeronasal system, which is specialized for smelling pheromones, which is related to sex and dominance and sort of how to function within your species as opposed to function within the world. So these electrodes are implanted in the accessory olfactory bulb, which is the part of the bulb of the mouse which is devoted to pheromone smelling. And this is the first experiment ever of measuring the electrode reaction. So what I'm showing you is a mouse. This is an anesthetized mouse that was placed in the chamber. This is under infrared light. Mice are nocturnal, so that's why the lighting looks a little bizarre. The mouse is sort of operating in its natural habitat. And so when I activate this movie, that click are the spikes that you hear coming from one of the electrodes. This is the rate of activity. You can see the mouse is running around. When it smells right under the chin, the firing of the spike goes crazy. This particular cell is extremely sensitive to some odor under the chin of an anesthetized mouse. And then the mouse systematically tries to smell other parts, and at some point, it's not clear whether this is some kind of habituation or just the odor has disappeared, but the mouse has effectively identified all the interesting features of this other mouse and has moved on. By putting different kinds of mice into this region, following what happens to this particular mouse, Larry Katz and Minman discovered that these accessory olfactory neurons are extremely sensitive to the genetic background of the mice. They can distinguish between two males from two different genetic batches, and also distinguish between the sex of the mice, and so on. So let me just move. Whoops, I'll just move on.
Distinguish means different.
Different firing patterns. Right. Right. Different firing patterns. And this is the last of my crash course summary of neurobiology. The signals that are propagating, these spikes that are propagating down one of these wires, these axons, ends up talking to another neuron by what's called a synapse. And so originally I thought this was some simple interface, and I now realize the synapse for my sabbatical is one of the major unknowns in neurobiology. This is an exceedingly complicated nanomachine. When the signals come in, they cause these pores, these channels that allow calcium to come in. When calcium comes in, an extremely intricate set of biological, biochemical reactions occur, of which the main consequence is these little balloons of transmitter, chemical transmitter, are literally pulled inside the cell to the interface here. They're merged with the membrane. They dump their contents into this very narrow gap between this axon and the next neuron. These chemicals bind to other channels, which open when they come in contact with the transmitter. These start currents flowing, which open up other channels, and then at some point cause transmission. So this is a digital to analog device where digital spikes come in and they translate into some kind of analog concentration release of chemicals. This is a hint of the complicated pathways. These are many of the proteins that have been discovered that play a role in the formation, the loading, the motion, and unloading of these vesicles. Many of these proteins are believed to play a role in learning and memory. That is, one of the ways you learn, for example, is you alter the density of these. There's mechanisms which, depending on the correlations of spikes coming in and correlations of spikes coming out, the density of these particular channels might change, the amount of chemical loaded in these balloons might change, the rate at which these things are delivered might change. All of these are under control that seem to alter depending on circumstances of memory. And this is a picture of a hippocampus cell. These little orange dots are a visualization of all the synapses touching this one particular neuron. So there's one of these complicated machines touching this guy, in contact with every one of these little dots, and what the whole functionality of this is just not known. And each one of these guys is capable of undergoing great internal complexity. So this is an example of the degrees of freedom I was telling you about. When I first began this, I thought I'd just be working on the theory of spikes, and then I found out, well, I really need to at least listen to or pay attention to these channels. And then the synapse people come along and say, well, the channel guys are kind of interesting, but you really need to pay attention to all this machinery inside the synapse, because that's where the real learning and memory and thinking takes place. And the system's pretty complicated. There are a lot of time scales and a lot of dynamics. And
these orange dots are synapses that connect to other...
No, these are where invisible wires are coming in and touching this particular...
That connect to other neurons.
Exactly right, yeah.
They're invisible wires.
The technology, you can stain a particular protein that's unique to this interface. And when you do that, all you see is this interface. You can't see the axons that are coming in. If you did, you'd see nothing. You'd just see huge cables. Right. So they're probably, I don't know, probably of order 1,000 to 2,000 connections all coming in. Each one of these guys has this level of complexity and can independently change its... Wait, say again? The needles are typically placed right in the middle of this the cell body. These are too tiny for current technology to stick a needle right into the synapse itself. So this is where you can see that that advances in nanotechnology will have a major impact on neurobiology with nanotubes of the right kind. You possibly could penetrate one of these guys. The cell, here's, well, you have to be careful what you call a cell.
The
The cell is this entire union of wires coming in and out. No, every one of these orange dots is where wire comes in and touches. Every one of these orange dots is one of these guys. Okay, so there are a lot of these synapses, and you have, for those Purkinje cells I showed you, there are 100,000 of them. It's really quite intimidating. Okay, so that's the end of my crash course in neurobiology, and what I'd like to talk now is more about olfaction, show you some data, and then give you a sense of what can be done in terms of theory. So let me just show you the early stages of the olfactory pathway, which is the part that where the most progress has been made. So this is a picture of the human nose. This is your nose in the nasal cavity, and when you smell, you have little chemicals. The what you can smell are actually little volatile chemicals of molecular mass, about 500 Daltons or less, 500. They're really tiny little guys, and they bind to these cilia at the neural receptors. They trigger spikes that then travel down these wires into the next part of the bulb, the olfactory bulb, where the first stage of processing, information processing, takes place. And this is what a schematic, a very crude schematic, as I'll explain in a minute, of the olfactory wiring looks like. So these are the cells that actually do the smelling, in the sense that they convert chemical reactions or chemical bindings on these little cilia into spikes that to start traveling down these wires. In mammals and insects and many other animals, there seems to be an independent convergence of this architecture of design. Many of the olfactory fibers collect into these things called glomeruli. Of order 10,000 fibers collect into these small little ball-like regions. These were known about 100 years ago by anatomy, but their functionality back then was not known. So all these receptors collect into little balls called glomeruli, and there are many in the mouse. There are order about 2,000 of these little balls, and then there's some kind of intricate processing going on here. You have 10,000 fibers coming in, and roughly of order 50 fibers coming out of these little regions. So the input flow is in here. Something really complicated, which is not well understood by anybody, takes place in this region. Then there's output data that go to these what are called mitral cells. So you get spikes coming down. This is the dendritic part of the mitral cells. Spikes coming down into these cells that send off lateral branches. These things themselves do some kind of processing. And finally, spikes are sent from here into deeper parts of the brain where presumably recognition, pattern recognition and memory is carried out. There are these cells that cross-connect the mitral cells. These are inhibitory cells that tend to make the firing of spikes more difficult. And these cross-connect, and then there's other cells, these paraglomerular cells, that cross-connect at this level, and these two tend to be inhibitory. So when something gets activated here, this tends to suppress activation in a nearby cell. And here's a little bit of the numbers for a mouse. There are 1,700 glomeruli on each side of the brain. They come in pairs, of course. There are 12,000 of these olfactory receptor neurons that feed into each one of these glomeruli. There are 20 to 50 of these mitral cells that touch send their input into one of these regions. There are 50 to 100 of these granular cells that cross-connect. And then something I don't show you, which is a big mystery, and people largely ignore it, and it's rather bizarre. There are far more fibers coming from the deeper part of the brain into this olfactory processing session than there are fibers coming from the from the nose itself. That is, in some crazy sense, the nose is smelling the inside of the brain more than it does the outside world. That this massive influence of the deeper parts of the brain and what the neurons are doing. So what I'm not showing here are all kinds of connections in this region, from fibers that are coming from deeper in the brain. The purpose of these fibers is not known. Maybe people have speculated that the brain instantly tunes the properties and sensitivities of the nose depending on what it's trying to smell. And so this is not a passive device that just receives information. This is constantly and dynamically changing its sensitivities depending on what the brain expects to smell or what the brain is interested in smelling. This occurs in vision also. The optical nerves from your, the optical fibers from your eye feed into something called the lateral geniculate nucleus, and there are more fibers coming from deeper in the brain into that nucleus than there are from the eye itself. And again, it's mysterious. What is the brain doing that it needs to send so many fibers from deeper in into one of these early processing stages? Yes? Yeah, I'm gonna get to that. The answer is it's not known. The smell, the space of smells that people can smell is extremely rich and complicated.
Typically, you have like a red.
Yeah, so that's what I'm gonna show. So this is one of the big breakthroughs that took place. That this picture that I just showed you was known anatomically by doing stains. People have known about it for 100 years. The biggest breakthrough in the field of olfaction took place about 12 years ago, where Linda Buck and Richard Axel, then at Columbia University, made the discovery that each of these little balls corresponded to a unique olfactory sensor. And then the 20 million cells that your body uses to smell, they turn out to break up into about 2,000 types, where each one is capable, each one expresses a unique protein that does a unique kind of smelling. And all the neurons that have that particular protein send their input into one of these little balls. So these little balls suddenly became understood as the input from a particular class of sensors. And your animals, especially mammals, have essentially 1,700 kinds of sensors. So this is the dimension of the sensor space of mammals. You have 1,700 sensors. So you have 20 million cells broken up into 1,700 classes. They somehow magically send all the fibers belonging to one kind, end up in one little region. So if you think this is probably a signal-to-noise amplification mechanism, everybody with a particular kind of sensing ability or that unique protein for smelling ends up in one region. So this is some kind of amplification process, and then the data. So that's the color coding, is each one of these represents one of the unique kinds of genes that's expressed. And the number of...
I'm sorry, 1,700 is the number of such units or the number of such different classes?
It's the same. There's a one-to-one correspondence.
There's only one of each?
There's only one of each. No, there's many cells that have the same protein that performs the translation of chemical to electrical transduction. So you have 1,700... Each one of these cells that actually interacts with a chemical expresses...
No, I mean these glomeruli.
Yeah, the glomeruli...
How many of those are there?
There's 1,700, one for each gene. There's one for each gene that produces a unique smelling...
But only one each?
Well, it's a little... I'm simplifying a little bit. There are actually two.
Yeah, but of order one.
Yeah, there's of order one. There are actually two. I need the significance, I don't know.
And the mouse is much more...
The mouse has 1,700. The humans have 1,700 genes, but for evolutionary reasons, we've lost about 2/3 of our genes. They no longer get expressed. So we use about 1/3 of the total number of sensors that a mouse does.
How is the producer, the sensitivity of these sensors?
Yeah, our smelling array is about 1/3 the capability, just in terms of the genetic breadth of this of the odors. Yes. Yes. No, I think it's 1/3. Yeah, we have roughly 1/3 of the number of glomeruli compared to the mouse. The genes have gone inactive over time. In humans? Well, I'm not sure how big it. I guess that would make them bigger, but I actually don't know that much about the anatomy of the humans. My year sabbatical was in a mouse lab, so I know a lot about mice. So this does have some implications about this 2,000 genes. By the way, as a side comment, these 2,000 genes devoted to smell makes it the largest gene family in the genome. The 1% roughly of the mouse genome is devoted to these genes that produce odor. It tells you a hint of how extremely important smell is for these animals. That's more than the immune system, more than the number of genes devoted to the immune system of the mouse. So one thing I want to emphasize is that each sensor, one of these proteins that binds to an odor and then starts triggering formation of spikes, each one of them is a generalist in that these sensors bind to many different odors. So there's a very simple rule that you need to know, which is every receptor in the nose can respond to many different odors. And similarly, any given odor can activate many different of these sensors. So there's not a unique. It was believed for a long time that there were dedicated sensors that would detect, you know, a smell that was particularly important for an animal. But it seems in this part of the brain, it's a generalist mechanism. We have many overlap. You have sensors with overlapping abilities. And another is that if simple chemistry tells you that these are generalist sensors, as you raise the concentration of a chemical in your nose, so from let's say just below the level of perception to hundreds of thousands times that concentration, more and more of these sensors get activated. It's just simple simple rules of chemistry. And what that means is your ability to perceive an odor over a range of concentrations is not an obvious situation. That is, if you don't have dedicated sensors, Each one can activate, if more and more senses activate as you raise the concentration of a chemical, that raises the puzzle of how your brain detects, to say, the smell of cherry at very low concentrations, at very high concentrations. In fact, psychophysical experiments show that over a range of about 1,000 concentration, most odors are invariant, that is, you perceive them to be the same. And yet, in the nose, what you're seeing as you raise the concentration is you have first the activation of 2 or 3 kinds of sensors, and then hundreds of sensors, and somehow the brain's able to sort out that behavior. So one of the simplest questions to ask in the theory of the nose is, where does this odor invariance come from? How does the nose, despite the fact that more and more sensors are being activated, how does the brain know to detect the or identify the pattern of a particular odor?
How sensitive is the somatic system? For example, in the optical system, you can detect the principal downward one photon level. I mean, how many molecules do you have to have for the system?
It depends on what kind of odors you're talking about. There are insects with specialized odor perceptions that can detect basically one molecule. The Bombyx moth, which relies on smelling pheromones to find its mate, can basically detect 1 or 2 molecules. Humans require about of order 100. But for the smells, there's a particular odor, maple furanone, which smells like burnt sugar. For some reasons, humans are exquisitely sensitive to that chemical. And that chemical you can detect to parts of about, you basically 50 molecules hit your nose, you'll have detected that chemical. For reasons that I don't think have anything to do with evolution. It's probably some artifact of the way the nose works. I just want to show you some. Yeah, you will detect. You will say, "I smell burnt sugar at this very, very low concentrations." Yeah, your brain actually, you actually raise a point, which is perception that there's an odor present versus what that odor is, and you can actually detect that odor at very low concentrations. But I just want to show you. See, how am I doing in time? I just want to show you that this schematic picture, which is the beginning of what many mathematical models begin, is a tremendous simplification for what the realities are. So these are the neurons coming in from the olfactory bulb. These are they branch out in an extremely intricate way inside one of these glomeruli. So this is a staining picture of one of these glomeruli. This is deeper in the brain. These are the mitral cells sending their dendritic trees in. And so you can see that these trees branch out in extremely intricate ways. And no one knows how to characterize these anatomical structures. And so at the theoretical level, we're pretty much stuck drawing cartoons of this sort. But the actual reality, when you look at the pictures, is far more intimidating and far more complex. And so this raises questions of whether you're going to understand something in principle versus understand something in detail. And no one quite knows how to capture that level of detail. Just very quickly, I want to point out that the structure of the nose, as I've pointed out to you, is rather similar to the structure of the retina. So in the human retina, light comes in and hits the sensors. These would be the equivalent of the odor sensors. But as you know, there are only 3 kinds in the eye versus the 1,000 or 2,000 kinds in the nose. Signals start propagating back towards the brain. And then these would be the equivalent of these horizontal cells. These things here that cross-connect are the equivalent of the paraglomerular cells. They somehow exchange information at this one layer. The purpose of these is rather well known in vision. The data, the spikes are modified and sent to the next level, where these amacrine cells, whose purpose is actually not known, despite many years of study of the retina. So they're causing a cross-connection and processing of information. And then finally, these cells are the ones that sort of summarize all the information processing and finally send the signals deeper into the brain with a vision.
The fact that the light comes down there, that's an artifact. What you described, the light came from right?
Confused
by this.
The human eye, for reasons that are probably purely an accident, has the retina inside out. The light-sensitive cells are in the back of the. The octopus has it right. The octopus has these cells right at the front.
The light just goes right through.
Yeah, this is very thin, and these are largely transparent. So the light goes right through and hits the cells at the back of the eye, and then it sends the information back forward. Where it then good example of. So let me, in the next few minutes, let me just head more towards theoretical territory and show you what's going on. But one of the key questions that I struggled with for the whole year, and I still don't know the answer to, and to my amazement that many neurobiologists like Larry Katz don't know the answer to, is what is the purpose of the nose? So you might think that's an idiotic question. The purpose of the nose is to smell. But in fact, there are many subtleties that make it very difficult to know how to start modeling the nose if you don't ask this question in detail. For example, what are typical or key odorants that an animal smells? A mouse was not selected by evolution to be a general smelling device. It has specific needs to detect its own species, and as it's running around little tunnels, detect food or predators. But it's actually very poorly understood what are the typical odorants that a mammal like a mouse smells in a typical environment. And so it's very poorly understood what were the evolutionary pressures that pushed the nose towards its design. For example, why are there 2,000 different receptors? If you're a solid-state engineer, if you take three sensors, each of them sensitive over a range of a factor of 100 or 1,000, it's very easy to discriminate between many different kinds of odors just based on three sensors or four. Why? What are the pressures that push the nose to have 1,000 or 2,000 different kinds of sensors? Another thing is odors don't occur as individual molecules. As Gunther's raising his question, they're typically mixtures, but what are the typical mixtures and the relative concentrations? And another thing that the nose does, which is not so obvious, is the nose is used for locating remote objects. So if you're an insect, like a fly, and you're moving towards, let's say, some rotten meat, you are flying and fluctuate, you're flying towards the odors that come to your nose that give you a sense of where to go are fluctuating in intensity. So you get these little pulses of odor as you're flying through the wind, and then the odor might disappear completely for a few seconds, and then suddenly another pulse appears. You have a highly fluctuating environment, and somehow the fly brain and the mouse brain is able to integrate those little fluctuating pulses and figure out that this is the direction to go and to track down to go up the gradient. So this is a picture from a paper by Boris Schreiman, who's thought a lot about what kind of algorithms are needed to follow a gradient, a fluctuating gradient uphill. But again, it's very poorly understood. It's very difficult to do experiments on live animals to find out what the nose does directly. Another is the question of what the odor space of the nose is, and this is probably the most poorly understood question of all. It's known that there, for humans, there are probably 10,000 different odors that people can discriminate. That's probably an undercount. This is a little bit of the organic chemistry. So this guy, this guy smells like a bitter almond, and this guy smells musky and is one of the things found in perfume, and this guy, one of these smells like, this smells like violet. And people have looked for years and years and years at patterns of these organic chemicals to see how they correlate with the smell, and no one's been able to figure it out yet. Presumably each one of these, like if we take this cucumber smell, that bonds to 300 or 400 of the sensors at once, and it's the pattern of the activation of those spikes that somehow triggers. No one's been able to figure out yet whether there's a logical organization of the odor space. So finally, what is the goal of a theory of olfaction? It took me the longest time to appreciate that this is what the neurobiologists thought was the goal, which is to understand the behavior of the mouse. That is, when it's smelling this other animal, it's doing some kind of classification and then makes decisions of what to move or what to do. This is not what I thought I'd be spending my sabbatical thinking about. Behavior is so high level that it didn't seem something that a theorist could make progress on. But that's what the neurobiologists are interested in. When you talk to Larry Katz, he's not interested in odor invariance and sort of the questions that I was interested in. He wants to know how the mouse actually makes decisions and gets around in its life. That to him is the real question. From my point of view as a theorist, one of the first steps you could make, the most modest step, is to try to predict the dynamics of the electrical activity. So you can stick probes like Gilles Laurent does and Larry Katz and other people do, and try to measure the patterns of electrical activity, the statistics of the spikes that come out of different parts of the olfactory tissue as a function of the type of the odor, the concentration of the odor, or of mixtures of the odor. And that's pretty much where most of the progress is being made, which is just looking at the physiology, but not at the behavioral level. Another question, which is extremely interesting, but still not well understood, is to explain the anatomy of the tissue. That is, if you were an engineer and wanted to design an animal to begin with, that had certain olfactory abilities, would you be forced to design something that had these glomeruli-like structure? That's what evolution seems to suggest. The flies and many animals, many different categories of animals across the animal kingdom have independently hit upon, or seem to have independently hit upon, the idea of glomeruli and the same transverse communication of information. So there seems to be not too, if you want to design a nose of some level of discrimination and sensitivity, there seems to be not that much flexibility. But why the particular connections and the numbers and ratios of the different cells? Why do you need 50 of these mitral cells for every one of the glomeruli, or of order that? And why do you need several hundred periglomerular cells? What do these numbers mean? We don't know the functionality of these cells, even though we can measure spikes. And then I think presently where most of the theory has been successful is avoiding detailed comparisons with experiment and just trying to ask what are the principles of how a nose could be made, let's say for robotic design. And here there's been a lot of progress. People have invented models that are only very vaguely motivated by physiology that succeed in doing segmentation. Segmentation is your ability to detect one odor in the presence of another. A classic example would be if you're a rabbit in a field of flowers, your nose is being drowned in the nearby smell of the flowers, and yet a very minute amount of fox smell would be detected in that surrounding very large concentration of floral smells, and the rabbit will know that it's in danger and run away. Synthesis is your ability to, when you smell coffee, that you don't act like a gas chromatograph and say, oh, I smell 400 separate compounds, each of which produces an odor, and then somehow that's coffee. You instantly recognize the coffee smell as coffee. And then recognition location. But there are models that basically achieve all of these tasks, but none of them with the sensitivity of biological systems. So in the last few minutes, I just want to show you a little bit of data and then just give you one slide about what the theory has done, and then I'll finish. And I think I'm running over, so I won't show you the one example of a mathematical model that has attempted to put together some of the anatomical ingredients and succeeded in, let's say, odor segmentation, and also explains concentration and variance. So let me just show you two pieces of data just to give you a feeling for what is actually measured quantitatively. So this is a picture by Hortvig Spores and Amiram Grünwald, two experimentalists. What you're looking at here is a segment, a 500 micron by, I don't know, about four times that amount, segment of the olfactory bulb of a mouse. They've painted this bulb, the tissue, with a special dye whose fluorescent properties depend on the local voltage of the membrane. And so the experiment is as follows. They watch the voltage-sensitive dye change its properties as they expose the animal to an odor. So they expose the animal to an odor, and then what you see is a spatiotemporal activity where different glomeruli, these large dots of the glomeruli, becoming active. And so this thing starts off looking like this, and then these regions become active over time, and then they deactivate. This is for a particular odor, butanol. If you switch to another odor, what you see is a different pattern of activation. So here you see just one glomerulus becoming rather active. And then for another smell, a fruit-like smell, citral, you see a different pattern. So this is an example of how the, and then you can do quantitative measurements. You can take, for example, these four dots and do very careful measurements of the changes in fluorescence. Then you get time courses of these different parts of the olfactory bulb. And again, all the information of the smells, of these different smells, is encoded in this time dependence, and presumably in this pattern. It's not known to what extent the brain pays attention to all these details of the pattern. That is one of the problems in experimental neurobiology, is you see structure, but it's not known what part of the structure the brain uses.
Is it known what happens when an odorless molecule is smelled? Is it binding or ignoring it, or is the signal just...
Well, you can do experiments like just blow air into the nose with no odors present, and the pressure of the air itself does trigger reactions in the nose, but the pattern of spikes is utterly different and simple compared to what happens when an actual chemical is present in the nose. I'm not sure what it means to smell a non... There are odors that you can react to that you're not consciously aware of. The odors that cause the synchronization of women's menstrual cycles, which is a pheromone-like... That's whatever that odor is, no one can smell it consciously, but it's evidently there because it has a clear effect on the physiology of women. And so there are odors that have a reaction on you, but you're not consciously aware of. But you would see spikes. The brain would show spikes in that case, even though you're not consciously aware of it.
The previous thing was focusing on four out of the 2,000.
The previous picture was a picture. This picture probably has about 40 glomeruli.
Out of the 2,000,
right. And you're just looking for this particular smell. What is the pattern, spatial temporal pattern of activity? And
what is the spatial scale compared to the whole?
This is probably about a third of the olfactory bulb. And you're only looking
at any more of these glomeruli that aren't being
visualized. That's
visualized
right.
In this very spot.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah.
There are hundreds.
Right. And the bulb's spherical in shape or cylindrical in shape, so we're actually looking only on one side of the cylinder. There's a backside which we're not looking at. But this is already enough to tell you that different odors cause different behavior. Here's a hint of, from the same experiment. As you raise the concentration for a given odor, what you see, and so at a particular point in this tissue, as you measure the fluorescent activity, and you raise the odor from 0.2% to 0.4% to 1% of this particular odor, here's the when the odor is turned on and then when it's turned off by exposing the animal, then you learn some interesting things. For example, as you raise the concentration, the activation occurs earlier and earlier. Here's a superposition of the three curves. As you increase the concentration, the firing or the rising of the curve occurs early and early. So here's a hint of how concentration might be encoded in the brain by the time when the activation starts to occur. And this data, which I'll just mention very briefly, shows that the sequential activation, so over time, this glomerulus starts to go active, and then another one always goes active in the same way, and then finally some other groups of glomeruli go active. So there's a temporal signature to these patterns as well as, yes, please. Right. Right. So I'm not sure how that happens. There are oscillations. This is the next piece of data in the last slide I'll show you about the experimental data. There are oscillations in the brain that start up that exist all the time, and also new oscillations that occur when the nose becomes active. And it's the phase coherence of these oscillations that presumably tell the brain when the odor is actually started. There's effectively many opportunities for internal clocks to exist to synchronize behaviors of this sort. Does that answer your question? So this is the last sample, last experimental slide, and then I have just two more after this. I'm sorry if I'm running over a little bit. This is... I'm not? How much time do I have?
You're not getting an hour.
Oh, is that right? I thought I was over an hour. Started. Okay. Okay, so I have a few more slides to show you. Anyway, this is some data to give you an idea of what the state of the art is in obtaining raw data about the nose. This goes back to Gilles Laurent's group, who's got some of the nicest data from, probably the best data in the world from the point of view of a theorist in terms of making careful measurements of successive chains of neurons in the nose. What you're looking at are projection neurons again. So this is one projection neuron, and this is another. What you're looking at is the behavior of the neuron to 16 different odors. So this is one group of data, and this is a different odor, this is a different odor, this is a different odor. So this is one electrode stuck into a projection neuron, and you're looking at its response to 16, each one of these regions of data as one different odor. These blue lines are where the odor was turned on and then went off. And then what you're seeing in succession are 10 repetitions of the experiment, so you can see how reproducible the spikes are. So for example, if we take this particular data, each one of these little dots is one of these little millisecond spikes. And what you see at this line, there's a certain pattern, and then in the next line, it's not quite the same pattern. And visually, you can see rather well what the statistical behavior is. There's a clustering around this period of time. It tends to be a clustering here. There's a sparseness here. But it's not perfectly reproducible from time to time. And some of these neurons are quite reproducible. And here you can see a large, it's pretty much identical statistical property. In other cases, it's very difficult to see that the same odor was applied. So these pictures, so these are two simultaneous recordings. So for example, this was recorded, each one of these 10 was recorded at the same time in the same order as these different 10. So this is a picture, sort of a big picture of the kind of spatial temporal data that one of the forefront laboratories can measure on the nose. And this is an example of, and you can see almost immediately from your eye, just by looking at the density of the spikes, you can easily classify these odors as being different. If I just chose, let's say for this particular odor and compared it, well, actually this is the wrong one. These two look almost identical. But if you choose, let's say this next one, let's see, what would be an example? Yeah, this one here, this first one here and this one here have quite different responses to the same odor. And this is the next, so this is the other thing I want to show you from this data. These are what are called Kenyon cells. These are the next layer deeper into the brain where the projection neurons are sending their information. And one of the extraordinary discoveries made by Laurent's group is that these guys, which are presumably the receiving end of all these odors, are firing incredibly sparsely. So when an odor is applied, this guy fires once, twice, thrice, and that's the end of the response to the odor. And as they poke around in this next part of the brain, which are the recipients of all the spikes coming in, these guys fire with an extraordinary sparsity in time And the purpose of that is not fully known. This theme of sparsity seems to be a current one in neurobiology. Michael Fee, when studying certain parts of the brain of birds that are responsible for bird song, has also discovered parts of the brain that receive thousands of spikes, but then these guys fire for just once or twice during the behavioral event and then stop firing. So this is one of the mysteries of that the electrophysiology shows, is these guys are generating spikes, but some of the things that listen to the spikes are doing, I don't know, some kind of coincidence detection or threshold detection, but the net result is they fire very rarely. And it's quite confusing how out of this very sparse information, whatever's further in the brain actually decides... Sorry? Yeah, this turns out to be extremely reproducible. So for example, here, when they, well, at least some of them are, here there's essentially identical firing just for this short period of time, and they stop. These are other, for other odors here, it's not clear where, I guess just from this data alone, you would say it's just statistical random firing.
Is the rate different with or without the odor?
No. Let's see, well, in some cases, like here...
Spontaneous. He's asking, what is the spontaneous?
Yeah, they're quiet. They're quiet most of the time. Yeah, before the gray bar, this is when the odor's turned on, and there's no firing of these Kenyan cells, as they're called. No, it's not. This is 1 second, and the entire response of the animals is within about 2 or 3 seconds after the odor. Smell is a very slow sense, by the way.
The number is identical to the 1700 or 300, maybe the original ones here. 300 or 1700 species, but the next ones have also the same number of...
No, that's a very good question. These number of cells are actually greatly outnumber the... In the locus, unlike the mouse, there are 800 different kinds of neurons, and these feed into 50,000 of these Kenyan cells. It's a small-to-many mapping. And so this raises, of course, the question, how did you sample these neurons? You have 50,000, you can only...
How many classes?
Oh, the meaning of the concept of class only works for the stage that's input to the projection neurons. You have these receptors, which are in different classes. They feed into the projection neurons. Each one of these guys receives information from presumably a large fraction of all the receptors. Yeah, so the way to think of it is these neurons, these projection neurons, are receiving input from potentially the entire array of 800 sensors for the locus, you know, the glomeruli. And then there's some kind of complicated processing going on where they send their input to this next stage. This next stage is believed by experiments to be where memory and the recognition occurs, and so it's quite confusing that the information becomes so sparse.
What are the two columns?
Let's see. This is repetition. No. Each one of these is a different odor being applied.
Right, but the other.
So this is a different column of odors. So this is the first 8 different kinds of odors. There's 16 in all. So each one of these groups of 16 is a behavior for a different odor.
I noticed that before the odor there is a firing on KC2, the first on the right.
Let's see, the odor, you mean this one?
No.
Yeah, right here. Yeah, right, yeah, that one, yeah, that's right, there's firing. Yeah, by the way, when you do the electrophysiology, just about every part of the brain is active all the time. This is another one of the great mysteries in neurobiology, is this background firing of spikes have any structure in it whatsoever. This is the purpose of the brain to detect what's happening beyond these spikes, or is the spikes themselves. I mean, these guys, I'm not sure this is the best data, but... A lot of firing in the brain, a lot of cells in the brain, you see spontaneous firings, whether or not there's any input data or not, and it's not understood what that background information is. Let's see, I'll skip that. So let me just mention some of the theoretical achievements, and I guess I won't go into the details of the model, but for those of you who might be interested, I'll be glad to discuss that with you, sort of the ingredients that have pulled together some successful models. So what has been achieved so far, largely over the last 10 years, people have at least discovered mechanisms for generating oscillations. I didn't show you the data, or I'll just show you this very briefly, that when you smell something, there's a oscillation set up over most of the, a spontaneous oscillation appears over much of the olfactory tissue. This oscillation is similar to an EEG, that as you put an electrode that's large compared to the cell bodies, over the center of the nose, and sort of recording the population response of many olfactory neurons at once. So there's an oscillation set up that whose purpose is not fully known, although it's obviously a candidate for synchronization mechanisms. And one of the simplest questions you can ask as a theorist is what generates those oscillations, what sets the frequency of those oscillations, why over a large network of neurons are the oscillations coherent or synchronized. So there's been a fair amount of progress on that, and people like Bazhenov in Terry Sosnowski's lab in Shefford at Yale, I don't know if you've talked with him, he's one of the leading olfactory researchers. And so these people have come up with models that put in roughly the anatomy of the mouse bulb, and they produce oscillations in the right time frame, but that's all they do. They give no insight into what the mechanism or the functionality of the concentration is. There are multiple models, largely due to John Hopfield, that have succeeded in these two tasks at the same time that explain how you get segmentation of odors, and in particular, the concentration invariance of odors. And if I had more time, that was the model I was going to show you, sort of the minimal ingredients that are motivated by the physiology that allow you to achieve these two goals. And then out of many years of work, people know that there's plenty of machinery around in neural tissue of the olfactory bulb to do memory and pattern recognition. But that's independent of the olfactory bulb. That is, people know that if you have recurrent networks of a certain kind, it's quite easy to do associative memory. And there are experiments that show, rather surprisingly, that the memory seems to be stored in the olfactory bulb itself in many cases. That is, there are experiments by lesions and right and by other techniques that seem to suggest that the olfactory bulb acts like a little brain all of its own, that it can store memories and do some level of recognition all of its own. So it seems to be meaningful to ask whether these capabilities exist just at the level of the olfactory bulb. But again, these systems are coupled to many other things. The olfactory bulb is receiving huge numbers of fibers from deeper in the brain, and what I haven't shown you is you go deeper in the brain, the information from the olfactory bulb starts to spread out into perhaps 8 other modules of the brain, each of which is also poorly understood. And the question of who actually identifies the odor, you know, the homunculus that actually says, I smell coffee or I smell a rose, is completely unknown. Where in this chain of events someone finally stops passing the information to someone else and a decision is made of some sort, this complete mystery in the olfactory sense. They know where it is, but they don't know how that, or roughly where that is. So some of the non-achievements, which theory has not given a hint on yet, is what is the purpose of the oscillations? There are guesses, but none of the guesses have led to quantitative confirmed predictions. One of the questions that interests me and I've thought a lot about, but I haven't really been able to make progress on, is what determines a large number of olfactory receptors? Why do you need 1,000 genes? It's huge devotion of the total genome. Why do you need 1,000 different senses to distinguish the different kind of odors that an animal has? One hint comes from chemistry, that if you have a sensor, you don't want it to bind too strongly to the chemical, to a particular odor, because otherwise that sensor gets blocked. So all the sensors in the nose you could predict have to be very weakly binding. And as soon as you have weakly binding sensors, you need to have a variety of them in order to distinguish among different chemicals. So partly the need for sensors that don't get locked up by a particular odor partially motivates the large numbers, but why Drosophila, the fly, has only 80 different kinds of sensors, and why mice have 2,000, and why humans have lost 2/3 of their genes. These are questions that aren't understood. We don't know the purpose of the glomerulus, this extremely intricate crosswiring where you have all these fibers of one kind coming in and then mixing with the many dendritic branches of the mitral cells. We don't know the purpose of the many inhibitory paraglomerular and granule cells. What I've described to you mainly is the excitatory pathway where information comes in and gets sent forward. These cells are the horizontal exchange cells where information at one layer shared with another cell and information at another layer. These outnumber the excitatory cells by a large amount. There might be 100 granular cells for every one of the mitral cells. It's not known what the purpose of these horizontal exchanges of information are. There are hints from experiment that they somehow refine odor perception, that if you can shut down these horizontal cells, you lose your ability to discriminate between two similar odors. But we don't know the purpose. And again, this question of what the centrifugal cells coming from deeper in the brain are. So I was going to talk about this Brody and Hopfield paper, but I'll skip that for lack of time. So let me just come to my conclusions. One is, to my amazement after spending this year sabbatical, is that neurobiology is an astoundingly young field, that even though people have been thinking about the brain for about 150 years, and very careful and anatomical drawings have been known since Ramanu Cajal from Spain did this pioneering work. There's an incredible amount that's not known. We don't still know the anatomy. Larry Katz just this last year was publishing papers on new wiring of cross. It turns out there are two pairs of glomeruli in each half of the mouse brain, and only this year people discovered what the wiring is between those two glomeruli, giving a hint of why there are two rather than one. The wiring is still being figured out. The physiology is incredibly poorly understood because we don't know, have the technology to measure all the input that's going into a particular cell, so it's very difficult to tell what one of these particular cells is doing. The biochemistry of the synapses is very poorly understood, and it's a huge industry in the neurobiology community. What are the chemical changes that alter the structure of a synapse as spikes come in? The genetics I won't go into. The thing that I've been concentrating on the most is the mechanism and function of the spatiotemporal dynamics, but we're at a really primitive level where we're largely trying to correlate the experimental data with the known behavior of the mouse, but we don't really understand the details of how that spatial temporal data is dynamics are generated by the physiology. And then I think this is the key question that I, and many others, keep running into over and over again, is what is the population of neurons doing? You have these 1,000 or 2,000 glomeruli, and these each feed into 50 separate mitral cells, and then you have these 100 granular cells. You have these large populations of cells, and that's probably the hardest question experimentally and conceptually, is what is the purpose of all these populations, these large cells doing together? So it's going to be a long time before we can answer one of the simplest Shakespearean questions of why a rose smells like a rose. But my sense is it's a pretty exciting area and many opportunities for the pattern formation community to think about these temporal dynamics and spatial dynamics and see if they can make some contribution. Thank you. I'll just finish with this one quote. So leave that quote there for you to think about, Lewis Thomas. Had a nice summary of why olfaction would be interesting. Yes.